Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Jane Donahue. Today we hear from James Bosworth, the author of the Latin American Risk Report newsletter. Speaking at the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations in Rockland, Maine, he outlines a set of recommendations for how the U.S. government, as well as private institutions and investors, can understand the current challenges and opportunities in Latin America, a complex region he argues is vital, though too often overlooked, to U.S. political and economic interests. This program was recorded live on December 9, 2024. We begin with an introduction from George Look, board president of the Midcoast Forum.
We are pleased to have today Mr. James Bosworth with us to speak on mapping Latin America's current politics. James Bosworth is the founder of Hexagon, a company that provides political risk analysis and bespoke research in Latin America. With over 20 years of experience researching and writing about Latin America, he assists financial institutions, investors, and analysts at corporations operating throughout the Western Hemisphere and helps them understand current events, potential scenarios in these countries, and risks they need to monitor. Mr. Bosworth is the author of the Latin America Risk Report newsletter and has a weekly column in World Politics Review. He's a certified super forecaster for Good Judgment Incorporated and a global fellow for the Woodrow Wilson Center, Woodrow Wilson Center's Latin American Program. I get that right. Boz, welcome to the Midcoast Forum.
Hi, everyone. I am James Bosworth, also known as Boz. And I appreciate the introduction and the invitation to be here today. I look at the list of speakers who you've had in the past and you're going to have in the future, and it's admiral, ambassador, author of various books, and hi, I write a blog. And I started that blog over 20 years ago. I was just a 23-year-old kid who was, you know, working on various DOD projects. And I was like, one Saturday, I was just like, hey, I'm going to start writing a blog and start writing about Latin America. And I hit the publish button every day and somehow write my way into being the expert on Latin America. And before I was the 23-year-old blogger, I was a 19-year-old college student. And long hair, earring, 4 years of high school Spanish, one course in Introduction to Latin American Politics, and I talk my way into a study abroad program, going down to Santiago, Chile. Definitely did not qualify to be in this program, but managed to get in. I'm on the plane flight down, about an hour in, and I realize that the high school Spanish I learned is not the same as the language being spoken by the flight attendants. And so, this is my intro to real Latin America. Chile's language is something totally different, and it took me weeks to even start understanding what the Chileans were saying. I bussed around Chile, I bussed across the mountains to Argentina and wandered around Argentina, and eventually I went to class, once I actually could understand what people were saying. And I took a class on Chilean history and politics, and we were working our way through Chilean politics, and we got to the early 1970s. Where the elected socialist government of Salvador Allende is in power and the economy is sinking, and we're heading towards that moment in September 1973 where the military overthrows Allende and Pinochet takes over and implements a dictatorship for 17 years. And another American student in the class, not me, it would be funnier if it was me, but it wasn't, raises his hand, the professor calls on him, and he goes on this long rant about how it's all Nixon and Kissinger's fault. The reason that Pinochet took over as dictator was all because Nixon and Kissinger insisted on it occurring, insisted on Allende falling. And after about a minute, minute and a half, the professor stops him and looks him in the eye and says, it's gringo arrogance. It's truly gringo arrogance to believe that Latin Americans are not capable of planning and executing their own coup d'etats, whether or not they are justified. And for me, it's this mic drop moment in how I understand Latin America. Because as you learn about Latin America, as you read about Latin America, so much about Latin America is about things that happen to Latin America, right? The Spanish colonized Latin America. The Soviet Union is influencing it in this way. The United States is implementing puppet governments or overthrowing these governments. For a time in the war on terror, there's this talk about the Islamist terrorists coming into Latin America and Iran's influence in Latin America. And if you look at Latin America today, the big discussion is, what is China doing in Latin America, right? How much is China investing in Latin America? How is China trying to influence governments? And what this professor's point was is that Latin Americans have agency. Latin Americans are making choices. This is not about what's happening to Latin America. It's very much about how Latin America is responding to global events and what they are proactively doing. And this is really important for understanding the region, not because the professor was trying to cut the blame for Nixon and Kissinger, who did terrible, awful things in Chile at that time, but because Latin Americans should own their own destiny, and that in every way that they made mistakes in 1973 when that coup occurred and Pinochet killed over 3,000 people in the following dictatorship, they own their victory in the late 1980s when Chileans organize their opposition and are able to vote out the Pinochet dictatorship and reestablish democracy and create one of the most vibrant economies in South America, right? You can't blame the outsiders for everything that goes bad. You have to be able to take your own blame as well as accept your own wins when they occur. So I'm going to talk today about Latin America. I'm going to try to keep it to what's modern, in spite of starting with the Chilean dictatorship. And I'm going to put three caveats on here. Number one, Latin America is not a country, as we were talking about ahead of this, right? It's a big, diverse region, and every country has its own details. And so as I'm doing this, you know, I could go into the nuances of how Honduras is different, right? But there's an advantage to talking about the patterns that exist across Latin America and trying to find a narrative that covers the whole region, even if we understand that every country is different. Number two, I'm not going to talk anywhere near enough about Mexico and Brazil. And so when we get to questions, feel free to, you know, ask me more about Mexico and Brazil. But Mexico and Brazil represent more than half of Latin America's population and more than half of Latin America's economy. And I've said if you're a policymaker in Latin America, you should be spending about half your time on Mexico and Brazil, especially Mexico. There are no two relationships in the world that are more important to the United States than Canada and Mexico. And getting the U.S. relationship with Mexico right is critical to our future in the 21st century. And so I really do, you know, in spite of me not talking as much about Mexico as maybe I should today, this is where I think the highlight should be for policymakers moving forward. In part three, even though I'd like to focus on the last 5 years, I can't do that without diving just a bit into Venezuelan history, because Venezuela is the narrative from the last 20, 25 years that in many ways defines how Latin America is today and where Latin America is going in the future. Around the same time that Pinochet took over in Chile in the early 1970s, a lot of South American countries went through military dictatorships. Venezuela did not. Venezuela remained an elected democracy for much of this time period. And Venezuela alternated parties for decades. And it seemed to work. Economic growth occurred. By 1980, Caracas is probably the wealthiest, best capital in the entire region. But it wasn't working for the poorest of Venezuelans. And the 1980s are known as the lost decade in Latin America. A lot of economic bad things happened that I'm not going to get into. But by the late 1980s, Venezuela is in a debt crisis like a lot of other countries. And in 1989, just as the Chileans are voting to reestablish democracy, Venezuela has the Caracazo, the Caracas Massacre. It is an event in which thousands died as people protested over the loss of subsidies and over the economic problems that the country was facing. In 1992, a young man by the name of Lieutenant Colonel Hugo Chavez attempts a coup, fails, gets on TV very briefly and just says, "We have lost por ahora, for now." And in 1998, he runs for the presidency, and he wins. And his win was almost guaranteed, because Venezuelans were angry at the political elite, and Chavez promised three things. He said, first off, the political elite have not delivered for this country. Secondly, the political elite are corrupt. And third, the institutions need to be rewritten from scratch. So Chavez rewrites the Constitution. He goes, there's a whole bunch of drama that happens over decades. I'm not going to reiterate all of this that happens. But by 2006, Chavez is wildly popular. We're talking 70 to 80% popularity in the country. He's reelected by an easy double-digit margin. The opposition is criticizing him for a long time. But Venezuelans, the average Venezuelan, is eating three meals a day. Their life is better than it ever has been. And some of that is luck and some of that is skill. Some of it is about the fact that Chavez was engaged in redistributionist policies that were moving wealth to the poor and bringing people up to the middle class. And some of it was about we were in the middle of a massive commodity boom and China was investing in Latin America and Venezuela just had more money than it ever did before. When your country sits on a field of oil and oil is over $100 a barrel, your country's gonna be doing well no matter what your governance structure looks like. But at the same time that things looked pretty good in 2006, the seeds for disaster moving forward were already there. And there were a lot of analysts sort of waving their hands going, this is going to turn out badly. And looking back, we can all see it. That's hindsight bias, right? We can all be like, oh, yeah, we all knew ahead of time that was going to be bad. But there were plenty of people writing at the time about how this was going to turn out poorly. Chavez dies in 2013 before, you know, the actual crash hits. But one key detail in here is that around 2003, he fired the entire management of PDVSA, the state oil firm. And oil fields can last about 10 years before they start declining, and you don't have the human capital. And so around 2013, Venezuela's oil fields start to collapse, and they start not being able to produce as much as they used to. And then 2014, for reasons completely outside of Venezuela's control, oil prices collapsed. From 2012 until 2019 or 20, take your pick, Venezuela experiences the largest economic collapse, definitely in the Western Hemisphere, potentially in history. And that's hard to say because Argentina is in the Western Hemisphere too, and Argentina has had lots of economic collapses. But Venezuela goes and drops about 75% of its GDP during this time frame. This is, by the way, most of it's before U.S. sanctions hit. This is all about Venezuela's own mismanagement of its economy. In the process of the oil booming in the 2000s, Venezuela's agriculture went downhill. So they weren't producing food. They had to import almost all of their food. They now couldn't afford food. Venezuelans went hungry. The average Venezuelan lost somewhere in the range of 15 to 20 pounds due to malnutrition. And 7 million Venezuelans, approximately, fled the country. A bigger refugee crisis than we saw out of Syria or out of Ukraine. It's about a quarter of the country's population. By 2018, the government there was so discredited that they ran a fraudulent election. They managed to remove all their opposition. So yeah, they won that election, but they didn't really win that election. The rest of the world, about 50 countries in the world, refused to recognize Nicolas Maduro as the president. And that's when the Trump administration and 48 other countries recognized Juan Guaido as president in 2019. And we start this big diplomatic crisis that you've probably read about. I start with Venezuela. But let me start now in 2018 with what's going on in the rest of Latin America. Because 2018 in the rest of Latin America looks a whole lot like 1998 in Venezuela. In terms of people's anger. It's like a switch is flipped. One of my favorite factoids about Latin America is the fact that between 1980 and 2017, only two presidents running for re-election lost. Incumbent advantage was a real thing. If you had just bet on the incumbent party in every presidential election, you would have made a lot of money. There was alternation of power as presidents didn't run for re-election, but incumbent advantage was very real. From 2018 until 2023, if you just ignore Paraguay for a second, which is its own separate little existence, from 2018 to 2023, zero incumbent parties won presidential elections. Two dozen elections in which the incumbent party lost. Latin America was angry. And it's not just about the fact that the incumbent party's lost, but it was about who won and the message that they won on. The message that they won on was the political elite are not serving you, democracy isn't working, the political elite are corrupt, and the institutions need to be rewritten. By the way, this is still true in Venezuela. The political elite aren't working, the political elite are corrupt, and the institutions need to be rewritten. It still exists in Venezuela. So we have a series of elections in which two dozen elections occur and the incumbent party loses, and loses in most cases to someone running on a fairly populist message. And it's not just elections. In 2019, to go back to Chile for a minute, the government announces that they're increasing metro fares. The increase in metro fares, by the way, the subway fares, was less than 10 cents. So, tiny increase. At that point, there's a long history of student protests in Chile. Students start flipping the metro turnstiles. So the government puts police in the subway stations to stop the students from flipping metro turnstiles. And within a week, the country explodes, almost literally, as several dozen metro stations are destroyed in arson bombings. Millions upon millions of dollars in damage is done. The police go out, start taking on protesters, aiming at protesters' eyes. People are blinded in this process. It's horrifying. There's a difference between democracies and dictatorships. A dictatorship can shoot its way out of a protest. A democracy cannot. And this is a clear way to tell whether it's a country's dictatorship or a democracy. In democracies, when police start abusing power, people respond. And instead of having tens of thousands of people protesting, Chile now had over 1 million people protesting, angry at the police abuses, as well as everything else going wrong in the country. The government was forced to back down, forced to agree to rewrite the Constitution. And later in this cycle, a man by the name of Gabriel Boric, who's only, I think, 37 now, is elected president. His background was a series of student protests in 2007. But I mean, he is somebody who is the most left-wing president that Chile has seen since Salvador Allende, and someone who is elected to rewrite the institutions of the country. This protest wave wasn't just Chile, though. We had protests in Bolivia and Peru and Ecuador and Colombia, where I was living at the time, where I got to walk down the street an hour before the curfew hit and saw just the usual traffic in Colombia, which is the worst in the world in Bogota. The streets were empty. I hadn't seen anything like that before. But as wave after wave of protest hit, police would respond too brutally, more protesters would hit the streets, and you'd have clashes. I was introduced as a super forecaster. So in late 2019, I said, well, this protest wave in 2020 is going to continue, and it's going to be worse, and it's going to be more violent. I got that one totally wrong. And the reason is because we had a global pandemic. Congratulations. Did not see that one coming. The global pandemic caused the protesters to be locked down, as everybody else. It caused the organized crime. I haven't even talked about organized crime yet, but organized crime had to go into lockdown because there's a global pandemic. Everybody sort of went home for a little bit. But just because everyone went home doesn't mean that the problems went away, that the problems causing protests went away, that the anger went away. In fact, it got worse. The number of Latin Americans who were middle class declined. There aren't the same social safety nets in Latin America, and so more people went into poverty, less people were able to eat. There's a lot of informal employment in Latin America, and so if you're selling food on a cart in the street, there's no unemployment insurance that's going to come in and help you at that point. And so this anger sort of festers across the 12, 18 months in which the lockdowns are occurring, and as we reemerge from the pandemic, everything's just worse. People are angrier. And that's why the anti-incumbent wave sticks. And that's sort of where we are today. There's a giant anti-incumbent wave in Latin America. Anti-establishment. People are angry at the political systems. But 2024 saw a few exceptions. And I think the few exceptions to this are really important to understanding where we are right now. One was in Mexico. Claudia Sheinbaum was elected as the successor to Andrés Manuel López Obrador, AMLO. Because, in part, AMLO had done such a great job consolidating control and retaining that sort of populist anger where the people were angry at AMLO's political opponents, the people who had been in power before. He was able to sort of move the political system to be the populist leader even though he remained in power. The other exception, Nayib Bukele. El Salvador's president, once put on social media, he is the world's most popular dictator. Wildly popular in El Salvador, I would estimate somewhere in 75% popularity. Some polls have him as high as 90. I don't think it's quite 90. I think it's closer to 75, but still impressive because Nayib Bukele came in on a message that the political elite weren't serving democracy, that they were corrupt, and that institutions need to be rebuilt, and proceeded to go after his political opponents, proceeded to implement a mass jailing of gang members. Approximately 2% of the adult population in El Salvador has been jailed at this point. That's a serious number. It's the highest incarceration rate in the world at this point. But the streets are safer. You talk to the average Salvadoran, there are places that you could not have walked 10 years ago that you can walk today because things are safer. And for that reason, Bukele is popular. And that I, like every other Latin American analyst I know, has had the experience. I've had it in Argentina and Panama and Colombia. I know other people who've had it in Brazil and Chile and Mexico, where you get into a cab and the cab driver tells you how he wishes his country had a leader like Nayib Bukele. To be sitting in Argentina and be told why El Salvador's president is so great is fascinating. Argentina now has Javier Milei, a person who came into power while he was campaigning by holding a chainsaw and promising to chainsaw the old institutions down. Ran against the previous parties that were in power and has been running for a year now. There's a wave of populist presidents around the region who we now must deal with the knowledge that going into 2025, 2026, you look at the electoral calendar, there's not an incumbent in sight who's likely to win. We are going to continue having anti-establishment populist candidates winning. And in that way, we're going to see, populism is a hell of a drug. You don't beat populists by being like, well, you know what? I'm going to be boring, and I'm going to defend the old institutions. The people who are campaigning on the same message as the populists. The only way to beat populism oftentimes is populism. And that's where Latin America, unfortunately, is today. So having said all that, and having approximately 5 minutes left before I'm going to take questions, I do want to address the U.S. policy question because, you know, U.S. policy towards Latin America does matter. And I'm going to make recommendations, but I'm not making recommendations for the Trump administration, right? Because the Trump administration, their plan is to deport 10 million people, to cut trade ties with most of Latin America, and to engage in potentially a war with the cartels down there. And if I had a recommendation for them, it would be don't do any of that. But rather, some recommendations for the broader U.S. policy community and foreign policy community and people who, you know, watch Latin America as well as the world. The first is Latin America matters. That doesn't sound like a recommendation, but it is. I truly believe that Latin America is more important than the Middle East, more important than what's happening in Eastern Europe, more important that's what's happening in Southeast Asia. I know there's plenty of experts, including some of your future speakers, who will disagree with me, but I believe that. And I believe Latin American experts should be willing to say that, should be willing to say that Mexico is 100 times as important as what happens in Israel and Palestine. Because we get distracted way too easily by what's happening across the ocean, and then nobody talks about Latin America. And I have to be an advocate for the region that I love, and that's really important. The second recommendation follows that first one. Latin Americanists cannot be afraid of the B word. And by B, I mean billion. We don't spend enough on Latin America. I hear US foreign policy elites tell me, well, we're just gonna do more with less. No, you do less with less. Ukraine, I love Ukraine. Ukraine deserves all the defense we can give it, but Ukraine got a $70 billion supplemental to defend itself. We send billions to Egypt, to Israel, to Pakistan. And there's a line item in the US budget for $5 million for anti-corruption in Guatemala. It's absurd. The little tiny money that we give Latin America And Latin Americanists are scared to ask for more. We're like, can we please have maybe a million more? No. I want billions for Latin America. I want 10% of what we spent on Ukraine or what we spent in Iraq. Because the return on investment to us spending on security and democracy in Latin America is just that much bigger for U.S. foreign policy. And it's really important that U.S. foreign policy analysts hear that. Vice President Joe Biden, under Barack Obama, made the case for $1 billion for Central America, and we never got there. But it, absolutely, $1 billion a year for the Northern Triangle should be the lowest starting bid, and I would probably start at $2 or $3 billion, because that helps solve the security issues we might face, the migration issues we might face, and just having a neighborhood that is economically prosperous for the U.S. to be able to export to and have working supply chains. The third recommendation is that we have to have metrics that matter. We have to know what we're trying to achieve. And I can say this in two ways. One is with the drug war. The drug war for a long time was a debate over marijuana legalization while we would go seize cocaine and fight cocaine traffickers in Latin America and then watch 100,000 Americans die of fentanyl here in the United States. Those are three different drugs. And we treat them as the drug war. And then we the U.S. government, and this goes across administrations, seizes cocaine and says, hey, we just seized 3 tons of cocaine. Look at us. We're winning the drug war. Meanwhile, tens of thousands of Americans are dying, and tens of thousands of Latin Americans are dying from cartel violence and from drug violence. We need to understand that the metric of success is reducing the number of Americans dying from drugs and reducing the number of Latin Americans dying from cartel violence. And if we cannot measure this based on whether or not we capture or kill a cartel leader, we can't measure this based on drugs seized. So having the right metrics is really important. In a similar way, having the right metrics for sanctions is important. We have a 60-year-plus embargo on Cuba. We've had sanctions, maximum pressure sanctions in 2019 against Venezuela that have been gently lifted by Biden but are still there. Sanctions aren't working. We don't know what we're doing with sanctions. And that's not to say these regimes don't deserve to be sanctioned. They're awful, right? They deserve everything we give them and more. And at the same time, saying that they deserve punishment isn't a policy. It doesn't succeed. And so figuring out how to rework our sanctions policies so that we get to the end goal that we want, rather than just say, well, they deserve to be punished, so obviously we have to keep the sanctions on, would be really important. And then one final recommendation, a small one, but one that really does matter to me. One of the most successful programs that the United States has implemented in Latin America in the last 20 years is one called 100,000 Strong in the Americas. It was a program implemented by the Obama administration to increase student exchanges. We're going to send 100,000 U.S. students to Latin America and 100,000 students from the Western Hemisphere coming into the United States. Because if immigration is the U.S. superpower in the 21st century, and I believe it is, the fact that so many people want to be in the U.S. is very important, then student exchanges are the spider bite that's the origin story for that superpower, right? And the opportunity to have people go abroad is how I get to stand here today. The opportunity to have Latin Americans come here to learn in U.S. universities and either stay here and build a great functioning economy or go back to their home countries and economically develop them is critical to U.S. success in the 21st century. We rise and fall as a Western Hemisphere together. There's no way that the United States does this without our Latin American partners. And so it's really important that we get the student visas going and that we get more student exchanges going so that we can keep those connections rolling and we can have a very prosperous century to come. Thank you for listening to me, and I look forward to your questions.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public. That was James Bosworth, the founder of Hexagon, a company that provides political risk analysis and tailored research in Latin America. Stay with us as Mr. Bosworth answers questions, led by George Look, the board president of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations.
Thank you very much. While we collect questions, I take the opportunity to ask the first question myself. You said we should be spending billions more dollars than we are. How would you spend those dollars, and should they be government dollars, U.S. government dollars, or should they be private industry investing more in developing resources in South America or whatever? What's the best way to spend that money?
So the answer is both, right? And the Biden-Harris administration has pushed for more private investment in Latin America to some success. But really, government money matters, right? I actually dislike the idea that you know, when we talk about Pakistan, it's all about U.S. government aid going to counterterrorism that's going on in Pakistan or helping the Egyptian government. And then when it comes to Latin America, everyone tells me, but why can't the private sector do it? Isn't a fair balance. And so I do think that the United States government should be spending more. Where can we spend it? So Vice President Joe Biden, who was a great Latin Americanist, and I'm not sure where it all went in the last 4 years, but Vice President Joe Biden believed in a secure, democratic, middle-class Latin America and said that we needed to be focused on you know, those three issues, security. There's plenty that can be done on security. Everybody who works on Latin America knows that one of the answers is police reform. We need to reform civilian police throughout Latin America. But it's not as if there's a button saying police reform and we're just refusing to press it. Police reform takes lots of money, lots of time, lots of personnel. You have to put people on the ground. You have to spend time training up police. You have to spend time firing the corrupt police who are there, providing the police the proper equipment, because there was one point in Guatemala where it was so underfunded that the police actually had to have little handguns and go bang because they couldn't afford the bullets to train. There's actual funding needs that need to be done for security. And that's not about sending more U.S. troops anywhere. It's about providing some very basic security aid that we're capable of doing. Democracy, there's plenty that can be done on just democratic building. And there's some small programs that go on, but we could ramp up our push for a more democratic Latin America, in particular helping minority groups, women and indigenous communities, build up their ability to organize politically and defend their rights against, at times, elites who abuse them. And then middle-class societies and, you know, working with the private sector, right? So it's about, you know, creating incentives for the private sector. The CHIPS Act is brilliant in the United States, right? The idea that we're going to provide funding for semiconductors and then have those semiconductors and then have those companies run semiconductor companies, you can provide incentives to the private sector to invest more in Latin America. And if you could, you know, offer them some sort of stability and guarantees, these programs exist, we could 10x them or 100x them in Latin America, and it would make a big difference.
So if we're going to provide this additional money, there are several questions here related to how we then may assure that we're not just funding corrupt governments and organizations. Yep. How do we?
Man, that's a great question. First off, there is a take in the Western Hemisphere that we're not going to provide the funding until we get the right political leadership. You know, we need the right political leadership in Latin America before we're going to fund, before we're going to provide funding. And it doesn't work. You have to at least put the line items in the budget, even if you're not going to fund the country right away. I think that we saw that in Plan Colombia. When the U.S. implemented Plan Colombia in the late 1990s, it was very successful. We had no guarantees that the money was not going to go to a corrupt government or a government but we managed to build out a program that had investment for Colombia, so that when the leader came along, Alvaro Uribe, he was able to very much use that investment and then also use Colombian investment to build on it. And one of the big secrets of Plan Colombia was that only 5% of the money spent was U.S. money. But having that seed money from the U.S. then let the Colombian government build its security policies out. The United States, unfortunately, isn't going to fund perfect governments. And that's an ugly thing to say, but it's true. The United States is going to end up making mistakes in this funding process. We do need to do due diligence. We need to make sure that we're not working with the worst of the worst. But we also can't hold back our money because this government isn't perfect. I mean, the United States government provides money to all over the world to regimes that are far, far worse than almost anything we see in Latin America without blinking an eye. And yet when it comes to Latin America, we're like, oh no, we couldn't do that. That person's corrupt. Latin America, I'm not talking about funding governments as much as I'm talking about funding growth for citizens and funding security operations that will keep citizens safe. And yes, there will be problems with increasing funding. That's going to exist everywhere. But somehow it becomes an excuse to not fund Latin America while we ignore when we do this for Vietnam or for Egypt or for elsewhere in the world. And I do want to drop that double standard.
So if I have this money to invest in as a private business in Latin America, what are the best business opportunities? Well, which countries?
First off, Mexico. There was a time period under Obama when there was when you know Obama was reopening Cuba, And I had a bunch of businesses come to me and be like, could you tell me about investing in Cuba? How could I be the first on the ground in Cuba? And I'm like, are you in Mexico? Because number one, Mexico's a lot bigger than Cuba. The investment opportunity is there. The security in Mexico in terms of the investment security is better. And if you can't handle the situation in Mexico, you definitely can't handle the situation in Cuba. Everybody likes the new exciting thing, and yet they don't necessarily want to go with the obvious. Companies that are in Mexico, until the most recent announcement of tariffs, the companies that are in Mexico want to double down on their investment in Mexico. Because Mexico is a great place to be, and anyone's there. Companies that aren't in Mexico look at Mexico and go, gosh, I don't want to be there. Look at all the crazy news coming out of Mexico. Look how violent it is. But anyone who actually has operations in Mexico knows that it's a fantastic place to be. It's a giant market, and they need to be operating in Mexico. Other than Mexico, I mean, across the line, there are plenty of investment opportunities in Latin America. I know there's a lot of green energy opportunities coming on. We do need better trade agreements with places like Ecuador, better trade agreements with Brazil. We just saw last week Mercosur, which is Brazil, Paraguay, Uruguay, Argentina, and now Bolivia, sign a free trade deal with the European Union. Now, I don't think it's going to be ratified by France, and so there's going to be some hiccups to come. But the fact is, we don't have a free trade agreement with Brazil or Argentina right now. And there's a lot that could be done with better trade deals. And so I do think that there's investment opportunities, but there's also there needs to be a push by the US government to find new and better ways to trade. The 20th century model of free trade deals is done, but we do need to have better free trade deals so that we can reduce the amount of friction for products going in both directions.
How about the investment in natural resources coming out of South America? The Chinese and the Russians are obviously taking advantage of.
Yeah, the Chinese in particular, and you know, there's a lot of so one thing I didn't get into, but when it comes to Iran and Russia in Latin America, they're trolls. They provide nothing good. Latin America does not need Iran or Russia for anything. Latin America has a really good reason to have a relationship with China. And the United States cannot block Latin America's relationship with China. China has a demand. They have a demand for copper. They have a demand for food products, including pork and soy from Brazil. There's a real nice match between South America and China in terms of a lot of things that are going on. So there's not much. The United States can't hope to block it, but the United States does have to at least be involved with Latin America. One thing that China's doing, I sometimes joke that China is speedrunning all of the mistakes that Europe and the United States made in Latin America over 200 years. China's speedrunning in about 20. But they are focused very much in terms of extractive investments, right? They are pulling copper out of the ground. They're pulling lithium out of the ground, and they're moving it back to China. The United States did this for a long time, too. Spain started in Latin America this way. The United States, to the best of its ability, needs to help Latin America move up that economic food chain so that it's not just an extractive economy, but they're actually doing things with the minerals so that there's processing for steel and copper in Latin America, so that they can turn the lithium into batteries and maybe even someday electric vehicles in Latin America. To the extent that the United States can help Latin America move up that economic value chain and not just be the extractive economy where we rip things out of the ground and that they get some pittance in return, we will have a better relationship with Latin America moving forward.
As you might imagine, there are a lot of questions here about immigration and migration from South America, including ones. What is the relationship between the lack of U.S. spending in Latin America and migration, climate-driven refugees, the role of organized crime, what are the factors?
And obviously migration is the hot issue of the day. Let me take the climate one first. Climate change does cause migration. We've seen a dry corridor, an ongoing drought in Central America that's been going on in some ways for decades, that's reduced agricultural yield. I lived in Nicaragua from 2010 to 2013, and I went up to a coffee plantation and got the lecture from the coffee farmer about how, you know, he had to be moving his crops up the mountain a little bit every year because the climate was warming. And at some point, the mountain ends. And you know, we've seen agricultural yields drop throughout Latin America. And what would happen is that the migrants would go from the rural parts to their capital cities. They wouldn't come straight to the United States, but they get to the capital cities, and then gangs would extort them. There wouldn't be job opportunities, and at that point, they would turn and go to the United States. Insecurity was a real factor in terms of driving people to the United States. After they lost economic opportunity in rural areas. I think that the insecurity problem is significant. When people come to the United States, it's a mixture of factors. Yes, there's that perfect example of someone who comes because they are persecuted politically and they deserve 100% fit under the asylum definition. And there's that other side where someone comes just for economic opportunity and there's no political factor. But for a lot of people coming from Central America or South America, there's a blend here where it's a bad political system. They've been persecuted, they've been hit by local gangs, they're under threat because a local gang leader said if they stayed in their city they would be killed, and they're looking for economic opportunity, and that mix is really hard for our asylum situation to deal with. One thing that we do have to do and place to spend more money on is asylum processing. One of the issues is that people coming to the border are not treated equally. They, some of them come in and they have an interview and they're passed along to and they're allowed to come in the United States and they get a 2-year, hey, you have a date for an asylum review in 2 years, go forth. Other people get to the border, they're thrown in a prison camp, pushed back across the border to Mexico, or they're deported to their home country. One analyst online joked that the CBP app that lets people apply for asylum appointments is actually Asylum Ticketmaster. When people have a lottery and they're they don't know how they're going to be treated, it's like buying a lottery ticket. Lots of people buy lottery tickets. If you don't know how you're going to be processed, if you don't know how long it's going to take, if you don't know if you're going to be pushed back or not, you make that attempt. And every time we change the rules, more people come. Because people are like, oh, that's going to be worse than before. I have to rush before it gets worse than before. That's what we see right now. But we see it wave after wave, every 12 to 18 months. People are like, oh, the rules are changing. I need to jump in and hurry up and get there. And so we have this lottery system to provide consistency and to process people effectively so that they can stay or go would be the number one recommendation. Now, I mean, we can say, should more people be allowed to stay? Should more people be pushed out? That's a policy recommendation. That's a policy decision. I have an opinion, other people have opinions, right? But making it consistent and providing the funds so that it's consistently applied would be the number one thing we could do to help the migration situation. I don't know if I answered all the migration questions there, but that was an attempt.
As a follow-up, somebody wants to know, will the U.S. wind up engaging in some type of warfare with Mexico over immigration? And why don't we give Mexico, this enough attention?
Are we going to engage in war with Mexico? Some of you read my article. I think it's coming. Everything we've seen from the incoming Trump administration suggests that they are legitimately thinking about engaging in some sort of violent conflict with the Mexican cartels. It's kind of scary. It's not strategic. I think that's the real challenge here. If you told me that you had a strategy or a plan to take on a very specific cartel or spot, maybe you could make that case. I'd probably still be against it, but there's at least a logic to, okay, I'm going to take down this one cartel that's doing this one bad thing. But to say you're going to bomb fentanyl labs in Mexico and somehow stop drug trafficking and change the game, it doesn't work, and it's absurd. But every single official coming in does think that we are going to go that route, and I do think that that's a challenge. That said, there's plenty we could do with Mexico. We should be cooperating with the Mexican government more to take on some of these illicit trafficking groups. And in the process, it's not about taking down the leadership of these illicit trafficking groups. It's providing security to Mexicans. If we made Mexico more secure, if we could get a working police force in Mexico that actually secured local cities, that's probably point number one. Point number two would be helping root out corruption at the very top levels, to make sure that cartels aren't capable of bribing some of the top levels of leadership. If we could do those two things, we would make a dent in the cartel warfare. We aren't going to defeat the cartels. We aren't going to stop drug use in the United States. There's no sort of military operation that does that successfully. But we could make life a whole lot safer for Mexico. we can make life safer for Americans in terms of our ability to in terms of not having the same levels of criminal groups that operate across the border. We could do a lot with security, even if we don't totally stop drug trafficking, or even if we don't say, okay, we've defeated the Mexican cartels. We're never going to defeat the Mexican cartels. It's a matter of how do you contain it properly, and how do you make the security operate in a way where Mexicans and Americans are both safer.
Let me circle back on the economic questions from earlier. Which Latin American economies have moved beyond the extractive-only phase, where they're totally dependent on their resources, into a more, you know, manufacturing or a more advanced form of an economy?
Right. I've been harping on Mexico, but Mexico is the easy answer, right? And we have massive supply chains with Mexico. Right now, to produce a car, cars will cross the border multiple times between the United States and Mexico and the United States and Canada. That level of manufacturing in Mexico is enormous and much bigger than we see out of supply chains elsewhere. There are maquilas in Central America, right, that produce textiles, right? So t-shirts and socks, likely some of you are wearing clothes right now made in Honduras or El Salvador or Dominican Republic. They exist, but that's not really up the value chain. Brazil has a major manufacturing sector that exists, and it has existed for years, and some of that is they have their own electronics production industry, they have their own textile industry, so there's a fair amount of products that have gone into Brazil. And then Chile does as well, but at the same time, if you look at Chile's economic numbers, most of Chile's economic numbers remain copper and agriculture, right? I mean, so while Chile is often seen as this bright, shining path for here's how economies can be done, ultimately the price of copper moves Chile's economy more than anything else, and so it is still very extractive. It's hard to move away from an extractive economy. It's called Dutch disease, right? Because once you have extractive economies, oil or copper or whatever it is, if those are so profitable that they dominate other sectors and make the country look for comparative economics where they can import food for cheaper than they can manufacture it because they're making so much on extractives, it causes the rest of their economy to decline. It really takes something countercyclical to fight against that cycle to make economic growth happen at that point.
And it's a question on how much influencer the United States really has in Latin America and how popular Americans themselves are. The question is Taylor Swift the only American who the Latin Americans still admire?
I have friends who flew to Argentina for the Taylor Swift concert. Taylor Swift is wildly popular globally. I think America remains a cultural touch point for Latin America. Latin Americans don't immigrate to China, right? That's really important. I think we underestimate that. Everyone thinks, oh, that would be absurd. We underestimate how important that is. Nobody goes, wow, I really wish I could go move to Beijing and live the Chinese dream. Doesn't exist. The United States is still considered, in many ways, the place to be, the most economically diverse place in the world to be, the biggest economic opportunity. When you pull people, an example for places like Peru, over a quarter of the population wants to immigrate and leave Peru and wants to come to the United States. Right? That's an incredible number. The United States is seen as the shining city on the hill. In spite of everything that's gone wrong, people want to work with the United States. People want to be allies with the United States. A lot of times, a big problem the United States has is, you know, countries want to work with us, but the countries also have bad records on human rights or democracy, and the U.S. sort of pushes them away. I mean, at that point, China's like, hey, here I am. And that's a real danger for us. We do have to, you know, when we have people who want to work with us, we have to find ways to work with them. And it's not always the prettiest picture in the world, but it has to be done, because if we don't, we hand over our influence in some ways to China. And so we do have to find ways to, while we should never silence our criticism of other governments, I think we should always, you know, if we see something, we say it, right? If we see a human rights abuse, we have to call it out. We cannot quiet our criticisms of our allies and then just point at our enemies and be like, here's everything you're doing wrong, and separate the world into the good guys and the bad guys. That doesn't work. We have to recognize that all of our partners have flaws, be willing to call out those flaws, be willing to accept when they tell us our flaws, because there are plenty of them. We can't just criticize those. But also be willing to work with partners who aren't perfect. That's a really important idea, because if we just push away countries, that's where China gains influence in so many times in the world.
And a couple of people wanted to move to Central America and ask you to, if you'd make some more comments on the situation in Costa Rica and Guatemala in particular. Stable governments or
Costa Rica is pura vida, right? I mean, that's the line. Costa Rica is fine. Now, it's funny. Rodrigo Chavez has been president in Costa Rica for a couple of years. And Rodrigo Chavez is a right-wing populist who was elected precisely because people didn't trust the political elites. They thought they were corrupt and they wanted the institutions rewritten. But they wanted it done in a Costa Rican, Tico, calm way. Everything about Costa Rica, even if it seems bad for Costa Rica, and people have criticized Rodrigo Chavez for how he's targeted journalists for some of his mechanisms of government, it's very Costa Rican. It's very laid back. I'm not worried about Costa Rica at all. It's a great place to be. Guatemala is a wild story. I didn't touch it today. But last year, the Guatemalan government went to an election, and they started banning candidates. It wasn't that the government wanted their own candidate to win. The government's candidate was going to lose. But they wanted to make sure that none of the candidates who would threaten the system could possibly win. And they missed one. His name was Bernardo Arevalo. I want to give Biden administration a lot of credit here. They did a couple things right in Latin America, and one of the big things they did was when that moment hit in Guatemala, where Arevalo made it to the second round, they jumped in full force to make sure that election kept going, to make sure that Arevalo had fair conditions, and make sure the transition happened. Arevalo won in the second round. It was a fight. It was a fight then for the transition. It took a month of protests for that transition to occur. The transition took hours later than planned, even though our USAID administrator, Samantha Power, was in Guatemala City for the transition. It was supposed to happen, I think, at like 8 p.m. at night, and it didn't happen until 1 a.m. the next morning, as everyone was sort of like fighting over whether this transition was going to happen. But Arevalo was elected, and it's very positive for Guatemala that we actually had this ability to have a democratic change and a democratically elected leader who wasn't corrupt. Arevalo now faces problems because his attorney general, Consuelo Porras, is corrupt, and she represents the past, and she's been trying to remove Arevalo from power for the last year. And Arevalo's really struggled to govern. He hasn't been able to obtain the congressional majority he needs. He hasn't been able to pass the budget bills that he needs to, because he faces a constant threat of impeachment arrest by his own attorney general, who he can't remove, because he's just too democratic to be like, you're fired out here, even though a lot of people think he should probably just take that step. The thing is, if you take that step, then you're just engaging in that populism, and you're engaging in that anti-democratic move. It's a really tough position he's in, but he's made it through this year, at least. Yeah, he will if he makes it another 21 days. Whether he can make it another 3 years in office is questionable. It's a really unstable situation. At the same time, it should be a U.S. policy goal to support Arevalo, because he is the right person for that job, and the other people who want to get him out of office are the bad guys. Like, there's a very clear good guy, bad guy distinction here in Guatemala, and we should be very grateful for who is president right now and make sure that that person gets all of the support necessary, because that's the sort of president we want to see across Latin America to have success.
And there's another hot spot that we haven't talked about at all, and a couple of different questions on Haiti. And whether there's a feasible path forward.
I wish I had better news on Haiti. I don't. The gangs control a good chunk of Port-au-Prince. You want to talk about lack of resources? The current mission to Haiti is 5,000 troops, I think. The former UN MINUSTA mission, which had an easier time because the gang violence was less and they had bigger government, was 20,000, 25,000. You're not going to solve Haiti's problems with 5,000. The president was assassinated a couple of years ago. They've gone through transition problems. They have not had a democratic election in 10 years, 15 years. It's been a long time since they've had an actual election that seemed to function in any way. And they have no election planned on the horizon. The news in Haiti is just bad news on top of bad news. And when you talk to the political leaders there about what their plan is, they don't have a plan. It's a really poor position for the country to be in. And there's no global country that wants to take on the role of fixing Haiti, because everybody who stepped into it in the past has failed. So I wish I had good news on Haiti. I wish I had some sort of brilliant plan to fix Haiti. If any of you do, everyone's looking for one. But unfortunately, it is the case that Haiti's bad news, and it's really difficult. We should spend more time, more resources trying to fix it, but there's not a clear path forward. It's going to be a mess for years to come.
And I thought we'd finish on a question about what we can do internally, U.S. citizens, to try and increase the visibility to our citizenry of things. And the particular question was, how important would it be for elementary students in America to have a world language curriculum, you know, study Spanish, where not only language is taught, but culture. And we don't seem to have that in our schools.
I mean, there's a separate question here of should we teach kids foreign languages? And the answer is yes. I have two kids, and they just absorbed foreign languages as kids in a way that I could not as a high schooler, right? Getting kids younger into foreign languages is just a benefit for U.S. culture globally. Every other country in the world manages to teach their populations to be bilingual and trilingual, and the United States has a real challenge doing this. Definitely teach kids languages. That's a slightly separate question from how could we get more focus on Latin America and what could we do? And I do think that there's something to be said for cultural education in schools, but I also think just there's an element of news coverage. You know, we go to the bright, shiny object in the world. That bright, shiny object isn't Latin America. It's really hard to cover something like Haiti or Nicaragua or Venezuela when it's the same story over and over again. The news doesn't cover it, and when the news doesn't cover it, people don't jump in and read about it, and therefore it gets ignored, right? And I think the ability to push for greater coverage of countries around the world is quite important. My goal for the last 20 years has been to write something on Latin America, right? And that's why, you know, boz.substack.com, smash that subscribe button, right? I've been doing this for a long time, hoping to get more attention for Latin America. It's tough to get people to pay attention to what isn't the bright, shiny object in the world. Trust me, this past week has been all about Syria. Syria, 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 Syria. And I think it's really important. It's amazing what's happened in Damascus. And at the same time, it's just another week in which we're not going to pay attention to what's going on in Caracas. And getting that to that transition in Venezuela is vitally important. I really do want to see just more coverage, more paying attention. And I appreciate you all being here. There's over 100 people in the room who are here listening about Latin America, and that's fantastic. That's where we need to be. Please pay more attention to the region. Please encourage people to do so, because that's vitally important.
Thank you very much, Bob.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's program featured a talk by James Bosworth, the author of the Latin American Risk Report newsletter and the founder of Hexagon, a political risk analysis and research company in Latin America. This conversation was recorded at the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations in Rockland on December 9th. If you missed part of the program or want to listen again, you can find it on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on Shows to find Speaking in Maine and many other on-demand programs. Music in this hour comes from Our Alarm Clock. Susan Tran is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and today's program was produced by Brenna Farrell, with help from me, Jane Donahue. Thanks for joining us. This is Maine Public Radio.